and gentlemen, welcome back. Kenrick here, audio only today. For those of you who usually check out the video version, always a pleasure having you all with us. Today we have a returning guest on the line once again, Lennart Svensson, who's with us, a few months ago. We spoke about his work on sci-fi genre, From the Right. The full title was Science Fiction Seen from the Right. It was a really interesting book. I really enjoyed that conversation. We had a great conversation. A lot of major kind of motifs in there, which I think it's a lot of fun to discuss and look at things, you know, like this sci-fi genre from a different area, because these days the modern, most of the modern films are just didactic nonsense from the left, most of it anyway. So it's going to be fun to speak with Lennart again. He has a number of books actually out since we last spoke. So welcome back, Lennart. Good to have you here again.
Thank you very much, Henrik.
So tell us what's been going on in your world, Lennart. A lot of things that you've been writing, of course. You were writing a few things when we spoke last time, obviously, but one of the most recent ones is Burning Magnesium that just was released on Logik Förlag. Tell us a bit about the book and why you wanted to write it.
Yeah, Burning Magnesium. It's a novel about the Eastern Front in World War II. And I get the feeling that we have on the book market today, we have many fact books, we have many essays about war history, but we don't have so many novels. And in that respect, I think Burning Magnesium is, well, it's kind of unique. And long story short, it tells about a man, a Swede, who gets enrolled in the German army in 1941. And then he goes east and he fights on the Eastern Front, and there is a lot of action, a lot of, if you will, adventure. And if you should compare the book to an author, you might mention Sven Hassel. He was a Dane, and he wrote a lot about World War II and Eastern Front and stuff like that. So you could say that this novel, Burning Magnesium, this is my version, inspired by Sven Hassel, and this is my war novel, a major war novel out now, and it can be bought on internet bookstores.
So tell us a bit about why doing it that way. I mean, obviously, as you said, there's a lot of factual books. There is a lot of important facts that we can dig into and that can come out of this, and I think that that's an essential part of the story, of getting the full story. But as you say, I think those who are ideologically on the left, they have been obviously more talented about telling the novels, writing the films, etc., that are fictional as opposed to the real factual stuff. And they have, if I can put it this way, they've made far more headway doing it that way than just going into the facts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be that people on the left, they have this writing ability. They have a certain, well, they have occupied the script writing and the novel writing businesses, but we have talents on the right wing too, so this is my humble contribution to the fictional side of right-leaning fiction.
So tell us about Arno Grief. He's obviously a volunteer, as you said, to the German army. Is there any how do I put this?
Is there any ideological slant? Is there any right-wing preaching in this novel?
No, that's actually what I was going to ask, but that's a good question. I guess you can answer that first.
Yeah, but the thing is, he is born in Sweden by a German father and a Swedish mother, and thus he has a double citizenship, and thus he first makes his military service in Sweden. And then in 1941, he also gets called up into the German army because he has German citizenship too. So he isn't technically a volunteer. He gets drafted. But at the same time, he has the urge to really test his strength. He has the urge to meet the elephant and go to war. And that is also a major part of it. He is something like a mercenary. He wants to go to war. He wants to test himself, test his strength. So he doesn't unwillingly go to war. He goes there with a certain zest and drive. So this isn't actually an anti-war novel, but, well, it's kind of, it's a vast gray area of having the urge to go to war, and then when you are at war, you of course see a lot of death and blood. But yeah, gray area. No other novel tells it like it is in this novel.
Interesting. So is it one of the, how to put this, could it have been written in any other area or major conflict? I guess what I'm asking is it more of a kind of a journey that the character, the protagonist goes through? And then this could have been set in any other, I don't know, any other theater or even other challenges that he faced? Or is it tied historically to this particular war and this this theater?
In a very general sense, it's an old story. It's about a man who goes to war and learns stuff. He goes to war and raises himself mentally. And when I look at my other manuscripts that haven't been published, then I can see the same pattern. A man goes to war and he meets the challenges. But the novel Burning Magnesium, as it is written on the pages, it is through and through German army. It's through and through Eastern Front. It's through and through World War II. There's a lot of historical detail. So I'd say it thrives in the World War II idiom.
Mm. How much research did you do, or you're already very familiar with this particular history?
Yeah, it came with the mother's milk, or how do you say it? I already, as a boy, I went through my father's library, and he had books on the Eastern Front, and I started to look through them. And then I made military service, and then I thought, well, it's interesting to see being here in the Swedish Army, in the infantry, to see how it's really done, companies, battalions. And then I sort of compared that to reading about more on the Eastern Front. And this has gone on since the mid-80s, so I have, in a way, been doing the research for this on and off through the years, 30 years, so... It's kind of massive undergrowth. It's a massive foundation for this novel.
Yeah, I've always been very interested in the history around this period. It's a seminal point in how things have developed, both for good and for bad, if you will. A lot of the effects that we live in today, of course, is a consequence of the Second World War and the outcome of that. Obviously, so it's a kind of a node point. It's a grievance point also at the same time, because, you know, one can speculate what would have happened if things went in a different way, but it is what it is now. But have you, when you were reading much of the material that you were interested in about the Eastern Front and so forth, did you feel that it was an accurate and truthful information you got, or were you still, as you perceive it, weaved up in the kind of the propaganda efforts, because there's so much, I think, exaggerations and just historical inaccuracies about that period.
Mm-hmm. I never got the feeling that they were hiding stuff deliberately. I mean, if I read British war historians like Alan Clark and John Keegan, I got the distinct image that they were telling the truth. It could have been that they have bias, that they sometimes said, oh, that they kind of elevated the Russians a little more. They were silent about Russian atrocities. But, well, on the whole, and if you, using your own imagination, if you live yourself into it, I don't think it's hard to get some kind of image of this conflict. What I want to say is that the hardest thing was to get the operational feel of it, the massive scale.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're in the Swedish Army and doing national service, you could get some impression of the massive scale and large units. We had a large exercise in 1985 called the Västgräns. It was, I don't know, 10,000 men involved, but to imagine the war on the Eastern Front, you have to get into the feel of millions of men moving this way, that way, the clash of armies. And it took a while to learn to think operationally in your mind, to get the feel of great power armies advancing and retreating. And that was a challenge, and I guess I have gotten the hang of it in this novel. It's got that large units feel. It's got the operational level. I mean, most war novels, most war films, they are about a little patrol. They go on patrol to save Private Ryan, etc. They are about snipers in Stalingrad, like Enemy at the Gates from 1994. It's kind of small scale. It's relatable. But real war movies, like there's a Finnish war movie called The Unknown Soldier. It premiered last year. And that movie has got this massive scale. You have the feeling that it's vast armies of hundreds of thousands of men, and I had the ambition to capture the same thing in my novel, the scale of it, to be more than just having a little patrol of 10 men.
Right, they probably do it that way, as you say, just so that the audience, or rather the individual that goes and watches the movie can identify, they can associate, they can kind of connect with the characters. It's easier, but as you say, the reality is much different. It's like you're just part of a massive machine, and you know, you might get trampled, you might get blown up early in the movie, so to speak. It's a brutality in war, but there's also, as you say, a quality, a character building quality to it. I don't know what do you feel about that? I mean, in terms of like the necessity of maybe not full out a world war like that, but conflict and battle overall as a initiation of from boyhood into manhood. I mean, it is an important step, and many people never get to be part of that or experience that, right?
Yeah, you could say you don't expressly have to go to war. There are other ways you could go to sea. You could be a sailor.
Yes.
That could also be a challenge. You have to go up there and leave your comfort zone. You have to go out and fight with the elements and really clash with people. You have to experience hardships. So you don't have to go to war. That's not the only way. But if we are talking about war, then it's, you could say, war brings out the best and the worst in man. So, and that's what I touch upon in this novel to a certain extent, that this man, Arno Greif, war brings out the best in him. He meets the challenges and he rises through the ranks. He goes from a mere private, and then he becomes squad leader, and then he becomes platoon leader. So, in a sense, he isn't expressly a war lover, but on this other hand, he doesn't hate war either. So, yeah, gray area. Mm-hmm. Last gray area.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of a little bit in the territory of someone like Joseph Campbell, right? They talk about the hero's journey, and as you say, that can come in many forms. It doesn't have to be battle and warfare. It could be going out to sea, going on an adventure, but there's always, usually along the way, there is an obstacle, a symbolic dragon that you will have to slay or something to overcome. And I mean, that's kind of, you know, in a way it's maybe a little pretentious, but I think that there's something to that archetypal pattern and journey that I think most, definitely men, would do good kind of going through. An experience, and I guess while we're on the topic of something like war, we are so sheltered and so protected and so isolated from any, we have hardship. I'm not saying we don't, but I'm saying it's like, you know, the reality we live in is so contained, it's so boxed in, and most men today, most young men, they don't get this experience. Would you agree?
Yeah, and they won't get it in the future either. On a personal, sane, rational level, I don't think there will be any war. And I don't think conscription and national service will return. So they would have to read war novels instead.
Can you get the same experience through a novel as the real thing?
No, of course you can't, but at the same time, or to move on, I would like to pick up on what you said about Joseph Campbell and myth and fighting the dragon. And I actually touch upon stuff like that as the novel progresses, because this main character, Arno Greif, he has dreams, strange dreams. And in those dreams, he meets a kind of guide, a mythical man. And at some point in the novel, there's this guide. He goes with Arno through a museum, and then the guide, he points at a painting on a wall, and there's a knight fighting with a dragon, and then he says, "Hey Arno, look at the man." And then Arno sees that the man has got his traits. He's got his face, Arno's face. So I have connections to the mythical side too. So
that
very complex.
Luke Skywalker.
Very
moment.
Complex. Yeah, it's. I wasn't kind of Luke Skywalker, if you want to. I didn't expressly sit and think, oh, now let's make a profound novel. But as I went along, I mentioned that I realized that, well, hey, I can put in some mythical stuff. It will balance and it would balance out the picture.
Yeah, well, there is some mysticism in that and in everyday life. And I think these kinds of experiences, these kinds of traumatic and intense and yeah, really life-threatening situations, those are the times when you do tap into something which is kind of above yourself, right? Those are the moments where people have true hunches, where they get a signal or a message or something, and whether that's the unconscious or whether that's something else that's kind of helping you along or aiding you to maybe so that you can make the right decision or go in the right direction, etc., or to basically to make yourself come out of a situation where you potentially would have ended up in trouble. I do believe in those things. I do that there's those kinds of aspects, especially in high intensity life and death kind of situations, that there are people that are they're talking. I mean, I've heard stories like that. They don't know how they came out alive. They don't know how they made it out, but somehow they made the right decision, whether that was they heard a voice or they listened to some impulse that they felt, and there is kind of that stuff to it, isn't there?
Yeah, they said that there were no atheists in the trenches.
Exactly.
And because in war you are forced to really think over the spiritual side of reality, so, and this is eminently the case of this novel too, Burning Magnesium.
What else would you like people to know about the novel? What else happens in it?
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff. I could go on and on, but
he goes to Ukraine later, right?
Yeah, some of the war action takes place in Ukraine, 1944, and they break out of a great encirclement. It was historically the Kamenets-Podolsky pocket. It was the spring of 1944, and in the novel there are 10 successive chapters telling about this breakout, and I am, if I may say so, rather proud that I could make it operationally viable and historically relatable to have this 10-chapter sequence. And, well, it's this, and then the war goes on. It goes on into the summer of 1944. It's the Operation Bagration, when the Central German Army Group was routed, and then there is the Warsaw Uprising, and then there is Berlin in 1945. And then the novel continues in the post-war era, and the main character, Arno Greif, because he is a Swede, he can go back to Sweden. And then he eventually becomes a peacetime officer in the Swedish army. And then at the end, he hears Germany calling. He gets called back to Germany, and he works as a private security consultant. And in the process, he gets visions from the war, and it isn't rosy, but he experiences this and that, and adventure and philosophy, too, is guaranteed for the reader of the book.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for those who don't know, obviously you're into the philosophical greats. You have a lot of good material that you've gone through and that you read, and I think that you've picked up a lot of that from Junger to even Wagner and these big philosophers and there is a Wagnerian, I guess, quality to some of this work too. But how do these influencers, I guess we can call them, that you've been inspired by, how do they play into this? Do you glean a lot of that material? Do you feel that it's important to kind of continue that legacy, continue telling those kinds of stories?
Yeah, Ernst Jünger is actually mentioned in the novel on some place. The main character, Arno Greif, he says, well, he has a German background. He knows German from his boyhood, and he can read Ernst Jünger's Battle as an Inner Experience, and he can read Storm of Steel, and that kind of plays in a bit. And then he becomes something of a philosopher himself. He constructs a philosophy of life based on his war experience, and he bases it on the necessity of meeting death and the necessity of willpower. And coincidentally, these are the things that I have written about in another book, Actionism, which was published last year. So I don't know. We could speak about that.
Sure. I wanted to ask you about that too, kind of tie it in. How do they tie in together? Obviously, the subtitle is How to Become a Responsible Man, and that's kind of part of what we're talking about, of the action of going into the war, defending yourself, your nation, these kinds of important parts of becoming a man. Tell us how they're related, how they tie into each other.
Yeah, in the book, in the philosophical book that I've written, we can call it Self-Help Guide, Actionism, How to Become a Responsible Man. I have kind of played down the warlike side of it. I have played down the soldiery side of it. But in a sense, it's a kind of you go to war. As in the Castaneda books, there's a quote saying, a man goes to knowledge as he goes to war, wide awake, with fear, with respect, and with absolute determination. And that is a truly soldiery quote, but it can be applied to an ordinary life too. It can not merely be applied to the sorcerer lifestyle of the Castaneda books. So that's how it is. In the ordinary life of a human being, he has to raise himself. He has to sum up his will. He has to really say, I want my will. And that's kind of the central part. For, I mean, in the culture of today, we hear that, oh, there is no will. Free will is an illusion. And I just shake my head in disbelief. My philosophy, actionism, it is based on the fact that will exists. It is so evident that I don't polemicize against those who deny it. So the basic elements are will exist. Another element is memento mori. You have to know about the limited lifespan of your physical body. And then you have to exercise meditation, some kind of meditation in your everyday. You have to calm down. Every man has to do that. And as the philosophy is called actionism, it of course means that action is important. And it also says that every man has to act. You can't just live a life in tranquility. You can't live a life in inaction. And this kind of action philosophy is covered in what I mean is the great moral and ethical doctrines of the world, like Protestantism and Hinduism. They have this in them. Like in Protestantism, it's God helps the one who helps himself. And in Hinduism, it's the karma yoga, where you have to perform work, you have to do stuff in your everyday, and that way meet God. You can't just sit and meditate in the forest. So actionism encompasses these attitudes. It is, in that way, it's a very action-oriented moral, and it encompasses God helps the one who helps himself, and it encompasses karma yoga, where you have to do work. You actually raise yourself mentally by doing stuff. And in that way, you can experience movement as a state. I mean, if you work inspiredly, you can get the sense of flow. And that is really what actionism is about. You do stuff, you perform stuff, you work inspiredly, and you experience movement as a state. And that way, you become a moral superstar.
I was reading a passage from the book. I don't know if this is, I think it's on the back side of the book. It says, essential reality is immaterial. Let me back up one line more. This is how it begins. Mm-hmm. Actionism is footed in perennial metaphysics, right? We can talk about that, what that means. But it says, mm-hmm. essential reality is immaterial. Eternal ideas and patterns rest in the casual sphere where they are affected, where they affect the material world and material man. All, quote, incarnated souls, unquote, in the confluence of samsara. This kind of ontological background makes this into a refined self-help guide, the statements and assertions forming the core of the book being founded in the esoteric thought of Western and Eastern traditions. So let's talk a bit about that and your interest in esoteric thought. I mean, we spent many shows talking about this. If we go back into to our archives, I was a bit interested in that. I've definitely been more interested in the Western part of that than the Eastern, because I did get a overload on that at that particular point. But there is a tie-in, and there is a shared tradition here, I guess, the Indo-Aryan tradition. Mm. And so that's something you're interested in, I reckon. Tell us more about your interest in this and how you feel that this is kind of important in not only this work, but in other works, how this inspires you.
Mm, yeah. The Hindu way of thought, the Hindu way of religion can be inspirational because it's philosophical. I mean, if you read the Bible, it's a bit more oriented towards mythology, ethical lectures, but in the Hindu way of thought, in the Upanishads and in the Bhagavad Gita, it's more philosophical, it's more ontological. It goes to the essence of things. And when I had read Bhagavad Gita and when I had read the Upanishads and read Sanskrit, I got it was like a stereoscopical vision where I could see deeper aspects of Christianity too. So that's how my philosophical foundation was led down. And that was the foundation for actionism. So,
interesting. There is kind of a rootedness in the Eastern tradition, but it obviously has a parallel into what's been carried into the Western tradition too, right?
Yeah, there is some Eastern flavor to my philosophy, but I am and I will remain a Westerner.
Yeah,
I will not shave my head. I will not go dressed in an orange kaftan. So, it's very inspirational to read Bhagavad Gita, etc. But Indian gurus have a way of being a bit too tranquil, a bit too, I don't know what's the word, self-goda. They are a bit complacent. They are afloat on a sea of Dharma. They can always quote something profound from some fine text, but
it is another religion at the end of the day, right? And religion is used to to manipulate and keep people in place. I'd feel, you know, not the beliefs themselves, not the spiritual essence of them, but the religions, right? What has the institutions that have risen around these spiritualities?
Yeah, that's true. And also, there is a kind of flavor to the Indian thought that you, as a Westerner, you can get enough of.
Yeah.
Carl Jung spoke about that. And I am, I'm not really a Jungian, but I know what he means. I am an artist. I need inspiration. I need symbols and shapes, and I can't shape my philosophy with Indian symbols, so I shape it with Western symbols like soldier and worker and God and Jesus Christ. Even he has some role, not a prominent role, but if I could say one fundament of actionism that is well, it's kind of both Christian and Hindu. It's the saying I am. In the Bible, in the Gospel of John, we have the saying, I am the light of the world. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I am the good shepherd. Jesus Christ says this a couple of times. And this I am saying, and this I've learned from Rudolf Steiner, this I am saying, this, it affirms the connection between the individual soul and the all soul, between the individual and God. And we have the same affinity in Hindu thought, where we have Atman is connected to Brahman. The individual Atman is connected to the great all soul, to God, Brahman. So in this way I kind of link together the great Indo-Aryan and Christian traditions. So in that way, my philosophy has a very, very broad foundation, and it's very, very firmly anchored in the perennial thought. And perennial thought is the old school, the traditional thought of the Western world and of the Eastern world. It is Hindu, Christian, mystic Christian. It is, in a sense, Gnostic. And it can also have strains of Taoism and Buddhism. But my attitude towards perennial religion is Hinduism and Christianity. And then it's a little bit of shamanism with Carlos Castaneda.
Interesting. So perennial, of course, means something that lasts for a long time, or infinite to a certain extent, enduring. What constitutes that? Is that is it just that because we have traditions that have lasted for a long time and that makes them perennial, or how does something become perennial?
They become perennial because they stress something more than the material every day. It is more than just the reductionist materialism that is all the rage now in the culture of the Western world. It is perennial because it teaches the perennial existence of the soul, the perennial existence of the essence in man. The essence of a man is his soul, his spirit. That is perennial. And the affinity between the soul and God, that is the absolute basic element, the absolute unquenchable, undestroyable fundament. So that's my interpretation of perennial thought.
And then, of course, you have the word uses perennial metaphysics, right? That there's more to it than just the material. There are things beyond which we need to recognize. There are things which we tend to forget, you know, as Westerners. It is this imbalance. I mean, if you think about it, many people in the Eastern traditions they're too kind of woo-woo, they're too caught away in the esoteric and metaphysical ideas. And in Western tradition, unfortunately, at this stage, we are too swept up in the material. So there's a bridge. Mm. There's a bridge somewhere in between, right? There's a balance between these two sides, and I think if you can lose yourself in one, but if you take both into consideration, I think you'll live a more balanced life, right?
Yeah, it is hard to actually take different traditions or different strains of perennial tradition and unite them. But I could say that I started studying Sanskrit in the 1990s, And at the same time, I read the Bible quite frequently. So from the 1990s until today, I have had time to mull over these things. I have had time to reflect and deliberate. So hopefully my book, Actionism, How to Become a Responsible Man, is the mature end product of my philosophical wanderings.
Is it kind of a self-help book for young men to grow up and become more responsible? Or how would you define it?
Yeah, it's my philosophy of life, and the angle is in the first seven chapters that it can serve as a self-help guide to men and to women. And then I go, in the subsequent chapters, I go into societal perspectives on this. I mean, if you're a responsible man, you take responsibility for your life, for your personal being. But then you can very easily move on to the societal level and take responsibility. Because in the materialist society of today in the Western world, there is no one taking responsibility.
Right.
It's all the rage today to say that, oh, I'm not responsible. I am offended by this and that. I want safe zones. But if you're a responsible man, you cut those things out and you focus on your being. And a responsible man wouldn't dream about saying, oh, I'm offended by this, I'm offended by that, I want a safe zone. So the philosophy, it has got some political implications.
Yeah, and I think that's an important lesson, right? Because if we think about it, usually what happens is that when this irresponsible, or whatever we should call it, these ideas of being irresponsible pops up to the surface, that there is people in place, usually in politics, but you know, in other power positions, if you will, within society, that learn how to take advantage of that, right? They say, well, I'll protect you, or I'll make sure that you're not hurt by these awful words or whatever, right? This is usually how we create a monster of political and governmental structures and organizations. And that's kind of where we are today. It's if you look at Sweden specifically, they have these, you know, kind of cotton gloves. It's very, very soft. It's like it's kindergarten to a certain extent. Mm. But then behind that, you have a very fierce and hard, in many cases, structure that is very punitive. And it's very when you encounter it, you realize just how ruthless and hard it is. But it comes with the promise of you being taken care of, right? When you give up, this is my point, when you give up responsibility, you leave it into the hands of someone else to start controlling your reality, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the surface, it's political correctness and it is multiculturalism. But under the surface, it's globalism. And globalism is relentless. Globalism runs like a steamroller over cultures and peoples, and they eradicate them all, and we are all shaped into one homogeneous mass. So, in a sense, my philosophy, Actionism, it's a way to remedy this. It starts with you. I have concocted abbreviations where you have three characters in a row. It's an acronym. Mm-hmm. I have an acronym. I have a series of acronyms. And one of the acronyms are ESWY. Everything starts with you. I mean, these truths are perennial, but to get things going, you have to start with yourself. You have to look at the man in the mirror and start with him and change him. Make the man in the mirror into a responsible man. And if you can change him, then you can change the world, but you must remember the order of things. Everything starts with you. You have to start with the man in the mirror. But if we are many people in this world who do, if we are 10, if we are 100, if we are 1,000, if we are 10,000, if we are 1,000,000, if we become so many responsible men, well, then things will start to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is what I've been arguing. We have to take charge. We have to start dictating. We have to have action, as you say. I mean, that's really fundamental thing. It's so easy to get passive, and I think that the the globalists that we're talking about, they are taking advantage of that. They're like us when we're passive. We're more easily controlled this way. We become complacent. We hand over these responsibilities to others. And specifically, I'd say as Swedes, we can talk more about this after the break because this is an interesting discussion. But specifically as Swedes, we've become very, we live in a, what would you call a mommy and poppy, mom and daddy state, if you will. I used the word kindergarten. That's what I feel like it is.
Yeah.
It's for kids. You know, it's children. It's not adults. It's not people who take responsibility. And I think a lot of the problems that we've ended up in are kind of beginning to culminate right now, where we have obviously hostile elites in place that are importing people from other parts of the world that don't, they're not in most cases willing to kind of play along in how traditionally Swedish society has been led. And now the chaos is beginning to be unleashed upon us. And no one knows how to act. No one knows how to do anything. No one knows how to organize because we've relied so much on government, right?
Yeah, they really deliberately foster irresponsibility. And the funny thing is, when I wrote this book, Actionism, How to Become a Responsible Man, I didn't exactly set out to write a book to remedy the world. I set out to write a book to remedy yourself, your individual being. But as I went along, I noticed you can scale up. It's got unlimited scalability. You could scale up this philosophy to the societal level. And responsibility is a key word. We are fostered. They foster irresponsibility. And now is the end of that. Because you could say that this kind of self-help guide where you say, shape up and become a man, take responsibility, I am not the only one saying it. We have, for instance, if we go very mainstream, we have Dr. Phil on TV. He was on TV 4 or 5 or 10 years ago, maybe even today. But he also has this way of saying, you have to shape up, you have to take responsibility. And in this question, in this problem, I praise Americans. There is in the U.S. a greater feel, a greater innate sense for the responsibility to shape up and not blaming everyone else.
Let's talk more about that after the break. I want to talk more about it because, you know, in America, you have this idea of individuality that's been very strong. At the same time, I feel that we're at the cusp where we also need to be more collectivized. In Swedish society, we're actually very, we're hyper-individualized. There's an almost ant-like quality to it. That's something I want to talk more about, get your take on that. But where would people go to pick up copies of the two books that we've been talking about so far, Actionism? And of course, also the new one on burning magnesium on the war.
Well, they can be bought on Amazon.com and Amazon.co.uk. And if they are available on Amazon, I guess they are. I am pretty sure they are available on other internet bookstores too. So it's available on internet bookstores worldwide.
Very good. And, of course, we have a website for you as well that we can give out. It's lennart-svensson.blogspot.se. We can have a link up to that, of course. You do have articles there. You have more information about the books there as well. And you do blog somewhat regularly as well. So people can check that out. You have your other books there as well. There's, of course, the one we spoke about last time, Science Fiction Seen from the Right. And then you have Redeeming Lucifer. That's actually something I want to ask you about, too, in a second. We haven't talked about that before. And then you have Ett rike utan like, which is a book in Swedish, obviously. So people can check that out. Okay, well, why don't we take just a short break then, Lennart, and then we'll be back in just a little bit with the second part. Okay, folks, a somewhat different discussion for you today. You know, novels and, self-help guides is not usually something we discuss, but philosophy definitely is. We enjoy discussing philosophy. We have many shows on that in our archives. The way to check those shows out or listen to the second hour of this show here coming up in a little bit is to get a subscription with us. This ensures that we can continue. Plus, you get access to an archive that has endless of material in it. Just the Weekend Warrior shows alone that we make exclusive for our members. We have 54 of them right now. these not only, you know, are covering current events, but some timeless research topics in there too that you need to know about. So it's well worth it. It's produced material, you know, we run clips in these. It's more lighthearted, most of it anyway. So it's definitely something different. So if you're new to the show, definitely check out Weekend Warrior. But the whole radio archive is on the members' website for you, plus a lot of exclusive videos as well. And we do need your support. We need people to sign up to help us expand and maintain what we have built. So if you're new to the show, please consider subscribing. If you're an old listener or viewer but have not yet subscribed, please consider doing so. And if you have been a member previously but are not a member anymore, please consider renewing your subscription. Also, if you are currently enjoying the one-year complimentary subscription that we smacked on all the accounts after the hack as a way to get you back into the member site ASAP, please consider helping us out with a donation. Doesn't matter how small, we do need your help. If you do want to support us or sign up for a subscription with Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency, just sign up as usual for a membership at redicemembers.com, and then when you get to the payments, choose the offline payment method. And then instead of sending us a snail mail as directed, just simply send us an email to redice@protonmail.com, include the length that you'd like to subscribe for, and also if you can, please send this from the email address that you signed up with so we can find you in the system. And then we will simply send you an address that you can transfer your Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, or even Ripple, you know, most other cryptocurrencies, frankly. Just let us know what you prefer, and we can accept it. So just email us, and we will sort it out. All right, thanks so much. We'll continue with the second segment here now with Lennart Svensson. We're going to talk more about Sweden and the dilemma we are in, actually, as we get a little bit more political in the second segment. A good second segment is coming up, so definitely check it out. Okay, we'll be right back. We'll talk to you after the break.